Now I'll introduce you to the political panel joining us here today. They're Niall Collins, Minister of State at the Department of Justice, and Fianna Fáil TD for Limerick County. Claire Curran, Sinn Féin TD for Roscommon Galway, and her party's spokesperson on children, disability and equality. And Padraig Tobin, Aintu party leader and TD for Meath West. Now we're also joined here in studio by Liam Herrick. He's the recently appointed new Chief Commissioner with the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. The Commission's going to be launching its new three-year strategy this coming week. There are a number of issues they want to raise with new members of the Oireachtas, issues that are particularly relevant as the new Dáil and Seanad settles down to its work. Liam, good afternoon. Thanks for coming in.
Good afternoon, Colin.
We're going to start with migration. The Human Rights and Equality Commission will be back in the court. I think it's next month. It's the next chapter in a case you took in the High Court against the state. You were successful in that case. It was over the accommodation of, in the main, single male asylum seekers who were sleeping rough. I mean, what prompted you to take it first of all, and where is it at now in terms of what will be decided next month?
Well, I think as listeners will be familiar, there was a change in policy in the last couple of years in Ireland where for the first time the state refused and failed to meet even a basic level of humanitarian support for certain categories of people receiving being received into the state to claim international protection. And in practice, that ended up being men that were arriving in the state. We refused to provide any basic housing or subsistence support for them. And this resulted in people being homeless and, as you know, sleeping on the streets. We attempted in the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission to engage with the government over a number of months on this, looking at ways in which the situation could be addressed. That was unsuccessful. And ultimately, we brought a legal action against the state. Last July, the Irish High Court found that this failure of Irish government policy, and it was one, of course, that had accumulated over a period of time. The state had known for several years that there was an increase in demand. This was an increasing challenge. The High Court found that not only was the state breaching the constitutional obligations that it has to support these people, but also breaching the Charter of Fundamental Rights under European law. Now, that's where things stand at the moment. Of course, we don't have any sense that the state has complied with that order and it's chosen to appeal it. And there will be an appeal heard in the Court of Appeal, as you said, Colin, at the start of March.
OK, and did the High Court take any cognizance of the capacity of the state, or did the state offer that as a defence of simply saying the numbers that came into the country overwhelmed the capacity they had and they were unable to offer accommodation to all comers as a result?
I mean, in the first instance, of course, the court has to look at what are the legal obligations and the nature of the rights that are being violated, and that these are ones in which the state can't abdicate its responsibility. Of course, the court will always take into account questions of capacity and planning, but I think it's important to bear in mind that the increase in numbers, which results, of course, from the war in Ukraine and an increase in wars across the globe, which has led to an increase in asylum applications all across Europe, was something that the state had full notice of for several years and had failed to plan for, and had also failed to implement its own policy commitments to provide reception accommodation facilities. As you know, this goes back many years in Ireland, where there were government commitments under the Catherine Day report and others to move from the system of direct provision we have to a more expansive state-provided system. We haven't built the reception centres, which is a commitment for many years. So when we look at...
Are you sure it's a commitment any longer? Because last week on the This Week programme, Jim O'Callaghan, talking to our colleague Justin McCarthy, was asked about the specific plans to build six accommodation centres. He said the plan is to buy a series of centres around the country, and when pressed on the number, he said, "I'm not going to finalise that yet."
Well, there have been several commitments from several governments over recent years. I think the pertinent point is the state's obligation to meet fundamental rights. If the state wants to say that it has an emergency which it couldn't have predicted, that ultimately isn't a tenable position in the situation we're in today.
All right,
and of course, it's also important to say that Ireland's not unique in this. We are receiving about the average number of applications for international protections among EU members. We actually dropped a little bit last year. This is a problem that other states have to face. And it's an issue that we have notice of. Of course, it's also relevant here that we are the richest, if not the one or two richest countries in Europe. And our failure to meet basic fundamental rights is something that can't be defended.
All right. In the same interview, Jim O'Callaghan said, too many people seek international protection who are not entitled to it. And the people who are really suffering from that are, of course, the people who are legitimately entitled to claim it, who may not be provided with accommodation because of the numbers that are coming in. So the position of the current Justice Minister is, as you've heard there, the problem is not the capacity of the state or the willingness of the state, it's the numbers.
I mean, I think that position doesn't really stand up when, as I say, we look at the fact that there's nothing particularly unusual about the process in Ireland. The minister did seem to rely on the low number of people that are successful in their claims for international protection at the first instance, but didn't then recognise that we have as high as 40% of those original negative decisions being overturned on appeal. So I think the question of reform of the process and refining and improving the process is one that everybody can get behind. And of course, we now have the EU Migration Pact, which will compel this state to reform the process right. We have at the moment. But the minister seemed to be focusing on either, first of all, reducing the number of applicants or also deporting at the other end, rather than what we would feel are the more important obligations, first of all, to invest in effective decision making at the start and ensuring that the rights of all people in the system are respected throughout the process. Nobody's against a quicker process as long as it's one that's fair and people's right to a fair and administration of justice is respected within that process.
Just before I go to the panel, the rest of the panel on this, the issue of people who are getting the recipients of temporary protection who are Ukrainians, we're seeing some calls from people in opposition. We'll be talking to Claire Curran in a moment, end the payment, the accommodation recognition payment of €800 and equalise it with other parts of the asylum system. We've seen in report in the newspaper today, Jack Horgan-Jones writing in the Irish Times that it's to be reduced to €600. What are your concerns, if you have any, about the proposals to make changes to this?
The question from a human rights and equality perspective is if there are changes of this type in policy, and of course the state does have discretion to make these types of decisions, are they properly assessing the impact it's going to have on individuals and their families? I think some of the concerns that are coming up from those groups that are supporting Ukrainians in Ireland are where people are moved from one part of the country to the other, disrupting schooling, for example, having detrimental effect on people who have built relationships with GPs and other services. So we need to make sure that there's a proper assessment before any such change can happen. If there are adequate supports to allow people to enter, for example, employment and the private rental sector, of course the reliance on state provision of those types of supports should reduce over time. But what we're seeing is for some sections of that Ukrainian population, for example, those with special needs, with disability, older people, people with young children, that it may not be easy for them to transition without appropriate supports. So I think the concern at the moment is that the motivation for these types of changes doesn't always seem to demonstrate there's a proper assessment of the impact those changes might have.
All right, we'll bring in politicians who are on the panel today. We'll go first to Niall Collins. He's in our Limerick studio. Niall Collins, you're a junior minister in the Department of Justice. So referring to your colleague Jim O'Callaghan's comments last week on the This Week programme, he said he was going to look at what the main driver of accommodation was, and he said that was the ever-increasing, as he put it, number of people seeking international protection. He said, we're not going to sit down and say our function now is just to create as many accommodation spaces as possible. How do you think that's going to fly in the court when the High Court order has already said that the state should be accommodating people if you appear to be refusing to do this?
Well, I think we need to put a bit of context around the discussion. The state currently, we're accommodating about 33,000 people across about 320 different accommodation centres. So it's a huge undertaking. And if you take that about 18,000 people presented last year in the country and applied for international protection, that's been a huge increase over the last number of years. It's nearly a tenfold increase if you measure it against a number of years ago. And it's hard to predict what the numbers coming in this year will be, but people continue to come into the country. So it's a huge challenge to us and it's a huge
Jim
cost.
Jim O'Callaghan estimates about 15,000 people.
Yeah, and I heard his interview and he did point out that it's not an exact science. You just can't predict with a degree of accuracy. But at the same time, I think the public understand that this is a huge undertaking. It's a huge challenge for the government and for the state and for the taxpayer to fund it. Look, I recognise the fact that the that Liam and his organisation took a challenge to the High Court. I understand also that that's under appeal. That will be heard shortly. But I think it's also important to point out that during that judgment, the court accepted that the state is actively endeavouring to try and rectify the situation. Right. And it was satisfied that the state is making efforts to try and improve the nature and extent of the rights of people who are unaccommodated. And that's a fact.
Look, you would have to accept that the situation has got worse. As of late last year, about 1,500 people in October 2024, when Roderick O'Gorman answered this in front of the Dáil, there was 1,500 single male asylum seekers without accommodation. The figure as of February 16th is 3,392. I mean, how are you demonstrating the efforts to accommodate these people?
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that the state has partnered with a number of NGOs, with a homeless charity, to try and help those people, to provide services, to provide day services to them. And it's also the case that people who are unaccommodated, they receive a higher weekly allowance than those who are afforded or provided with state accommodation while their application for international protection is being adjudicated. Right. So look, I mean, there's nobody resiling from any responsibility here. It is a huge challenge. It is a huge undertaking. There is a lot of resources being put into the whole area of migration management. You just have to look at the number of people who are now working in terms of processing the international protection applications. We now have about 650 people employed in doing that, and that number will grow. Similarly, the International Protection Appeals Tribunal, the number of people working in that has been ramped up. So there's a lot going on. We have to try to be able to react as quickly as possible. We've done that in relation to the list of safe countries, and that is obviously concluded in a sharp increase in the number of people who are being denied international protection in the first instance. So it's about trying to create a process and an application process which reacts quickly to the situation. And I think part of that will also be the establishment of a migration unit within the court system to deal with appeals which ultimately end up in the court process also.
I do want to ask you just before I go to the other guests in studio, what Jim O'Callaghan said. He said too many people seek international protection who are not entitled to it, and he was relating that to the accommodation system. But that's not determined until the determination has been made. So people arriving and who make the application still have to be accommodated until that's determined, don't they?
Well, I think what I took from that is I think he was rightly making the point that we have increased the list of safe countries from which applicants are coming from. And as a result of that, more people are being refused international protection in the first instance. And I think as that list grows, you will see more people who are presenting and seeking international protection being refused it. That's certainly what I took
from it. And what do I take from that the plan is not to accommodate them while that determination has been made if they're coming from a safe country?
No, you can't take that. Look, I mean, in relation to the whole accommodation, and again, Jim O'Callaghan was asked this, he'd been asked this on a number of occasions it is the intention of the government and the Department of Justice when the function finally transfers into us in the next number of weeks, that there will be a plan to roll out at least six, if not more, large-scale accommodation centres.
All right. Padraig Tobin, that same question, you know, the people saying there are a number of people who are arriving seeking international protection who are not entitled to it. It takes a period of time before that's determined. Until that's determined, they still have to be accommodated in the state. What's your answer to that?
I think it is. The figures are quite amazing on this. So between 2019 and 2023, about less than a quarter of those seeking application in this country failed. And then, according to the minister, 65% last year failed the first instance. And in January this year, 80% failed in this instance. So there's a big question over why the application process has become either far stricter or the cohort of people applying is radically different. I believe the government is getting far stricter than they were for the first 5 years in relation to it. The second thing is, for sure, everybody has to be accommodated on their application. But I do think that if you have a fast process, right now thousands of people are waiting maybe 2 or 3 years for their application to be processed. If you have a speedy process, it means you don't have the end result of accommodating people who are not asylum seekers.
That saves money and actually makes more places available to people. I just want you to clarify that. If a process is fast, but if it's to be fair and compliant, that system is going to need more resources, isn't it?
Oh, there's no doubt. The system needs resources anyways. Okay, so if you have... we spent €1 billion last year in terms of accommodating 35,000 people who are seeking accommodation. And the fact that we are waiting so long to actually make the decision, it is costing this country billions of euros. If we make that decision faster, yes, by front loading the resources into the application process, making those decisions faster, which is actually better for the applicant as well, we actually save money and it means we have more resources in terms of providing that accommodation. So that's a key mistake of the government. They're waiting 2 and 3 years for the first application to be processed.
Right. Niall Collins just said that there are more resources being devoted to the system at all stages, and there's a unit within the courts proposed as well.
There are more resources, but the resources were extremely low previously. And also, I honestly believe another reason why the numbers have increased in Ireland so much in the last year is because we have sent out a message that if you apply to Ireland for asylum, it'll take 2 or 3 years before a decision is made. And if a decision is made and you get a deportation order, unlikely that the deportation order will be actually affected.
You believe that, or there is research to show that?
Well, if, for example, there is research to show that 85% of people who receive deportation orders in this country do not have it enforced, which is, again, is quite shocking.
That's a different question with respect. I'm saying you believe people are coming here because it's taking 2 to 3 years. I'm saying you're basing that on a gut instinct rather than any qualitative research, asking people who were unsuccessful why they came here.
I'm basing it on the fact that people are rational and that if there is a process that is taking it, that is not strict, okay, that takes an extremely long time, and even if you fail it, you get to stay in the country, it is likely then it'll be an attractive place for people to come.
All right. Claire Curran, what's, I suppose, different about how Sinn Féin would approach the issue of, you've said before, you want a system that's fast and efficient and fair. Mm-hmm. What resources need to be devoted to the system in order to give people decisions adequately and to accommodate them while they're waiting for that decision?
Yeah, well, look, I'm not sure why the government are still dancing around the 6 reception centres. It's a number of years now since Catherine Day said that was needed, and now they're saying, well, we'll look again at what's needed. Like, what was the point in even doing the report if they're still not going to implement that? And the government policy to date in terms of accommodation has failed because it's been about who has a hotel or an empty building and they can put their hand up and say, we'll make a load of money and we'll take them in. And that's been the policy, and that has failed and failed and failed. It's lined the pockets of private owners and it has had an impact on a number of communities. So the first thing is put the reception centres in place, and if we have a process that is efficient, then you don't have constant look for accommodation. You have people coming in, they're processed, they remain or they leave, and then you have your place again. The reception centres don't need to be opened all of the time, but let's have them in place, put them in place, and then let's be able to accommodate and meet our requirements and our international obligations.
And you want a fully public system of reception centres, and you think 6 is the number to go for, do you?
Well, if I remember rightly, the Catherine Day report had recommended 6, and that was a number of years ago, and we're still not doing that. And why aren't we doing it?
And you want them located, you want to go by the Pubel Index of Deprivation and locate those in areas that are not socially deprived.
Yeah, and I think that's just common sense. I mean, this issue is going on for a very, very long time. My hometown of Ballardrín took in Syrian refugees back in 2017. We are the most deprived town in the county, the highest unemployment rate, and it's been really hard, and the town has got nothing as a result. Money was given by the department for a new childcare facility that was subsequently pulled, and that's what causes the tension and the annoyance that is totally and utterly avoidable if the departments all work together and do their bit in supporting the communities. It's not rocket science.
If you were acquiring and building facilities that were in more affluent areas, obviously the state would have to front up and pay more for those builds and accommodation, which is a choice you'd be prepared to make, is it?
I think in a lot of cases you wouldn't even need to build centres. I think we have lots of vacant buildings. I think we need to do a job work. It should have been done years ago. But when you say affluent, for me it's more about where are the communities that have resources? Do I put them into a town that's a black spot in terms of public transport, or do I put them into somewhere where they have transport? And like, that's good for the people coming as well. I mean, the people in Balladreen, for example, and I've met the children in the Erock Centre, a number of them. The pool that was opened has been closed now for a number of years. There's a playground at the top end of the town and they have nothing to do all day. They're just in a hotel wandering around. And I've heard that from the staff themselves. It's a horrible life. I mean, it is in general anyway, sure, to be in a reception centre, but there is nothing there for them. That's not good for them either.
Okay, so
Just a point, the state, like Roger O'Gorman bought 30 buildings 2 years ago for the purpose of making them available for people in relation to IPASS. Only one of those buildings are still in use. The OPW has 60 empty buildings at the moment. There is a competency issue in terms of the government providing these reception centres as well that has to be looked at.
Okay, I want to move on to the issue of deportation flights. Liam Herrick, is the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission have any particular position on deportation flights or how the state should deal with people when it reaches the end of a process, they fail and they are being told to exit the state or the state is exiting them?
I mean, I think any process will ultimately have an element where the use of force and deportation is an element of that process. But it's been quite disappointing to see some of the rhetoric in the last couple of weeks on this, which seemed to suggest that the number of deportations should be a goal in and of itself, that increasing deportations is an object of public policy. When a deportation happens, first of all, that's incredibly invasive and disruptive to individuals and families and can cause a lot of harm. But also, of course, it's incredibly expensive for the state, not just in terms of the cost of deportation, but also in terms of the cost of legal processes that precede it. I mean, if anything, an effective system should be trying to minimise the extent to which we might ever need to resort to deportation. And I think some of the emphasis on this element of the process, I have to say, reminds me a little bit of the discourse in the United Kingdom over recent years, where getting planes off the ground to bring people to other parts of the world was seen as the goal of policy rather than an avoidable consequence. So, yes, of course, there will be deportation in any process. You want to try to minimise it. For example, you know, voluntary return and supporting people. The International Organization of Migration has been doing that for years. There are countries that have low rates of deportation because they find other means of resolving unsuccessful applications. So I think it's part of a wider piece with the Migration Pact that if we're going to have elements like detention or deportation in our process, we're also then going to have to build in very significant systems of safeguards and oversight, which again will be complex and demanding.
All right. Niall Collins, I think there's a €5 million contract for deportations has been put out to tender by the state. Is there, I suppose, an imperative then, once the €5 million is paid under this, if it's to be paid up front, that the state will then try to get the value out of it?
Well, I think any coherent migration system is going to have a facility for the state to be able to carry out deportations. I mean, that's just a fact and a given. And I think any migration system or processing system or application system that doesn't have that facility built into it ultimately is doomed for failure. So I think it's right that the state has that capacity. You know, it's going to be obviously part of the Migration and Asylum Pact, the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, and there'll be legislation coming before the Dáil in the forthcoming 12 months in relation to that. We opted in last year, as you know. The number of deportation orders signed last year increased significantly, in the order of 2,400. The number of deportation orders signed in the early part of this year, 2025, is in the order of 532. So it has to be part of a system, and there has to be the facility to be able to carry out deportations. But I think it's important to point out also that the vast majority of people who leave this state when their application process comes to a final conclusion leave voluntarily.
All right. Is that the best and efficient means to get people to leave? Because I think it's around €350,000 per flight. The Office of Government Procurement has put an estimated price tag of €5 million on that. But we put in an FOI request last year looking for the business case, the cost benefit analysis used to support the tender for the charter flights for deportation, and we requested records of meetings at which a business case or cost benefit analysis were discussed. And there was a search of e-submissions, e-documents, email accounts of staff in the relevant areas, and they came back to us and said there was nothing, no records, no cost benefit analysis, no business case, and no meetings to even discuss it.
Well, look, I mean, I'm new to the department, so I wasn't party to that or involved in that decision or that discussion. But look, what I would say to you is my reaction is that you have to have the facility in place, and it is going to be a costly part of the process. There is no doubt about it. The whole area of migration control and border control, and indeed the provision of accommodation, as others have said and as we all well know, is a costly business. It's costing the taxpayer day in, day out, but we have to have the facility in place.
I'm asking about the principle of governance, because the person who replied to a request said the decision maker is satisfied that there are no records. They said there was a tendering process commenced, and I'll quote it directly just to give it to you. It says the decision maker is satisfied there are no records coming within the scope of your request and has advised that the tendering process was commenced as a consequence of the ending of the moratorium on deportations. It was a logical action flowing from that decision. But if you say it's going to be value, there's no cost benefit analysis to support that.
Okay, well, look, deportation flights is something which is pretty unique. It's not something which happens every single day of the week. If there's a tender process, if there has been a formal tender process, it's well known that government procurement and government tender processes, they may well have only been one expression of interest through the tender process. I don't know. I haven't seen the detail in relation to it. Maybe give me a chance to research it within our own department before you ask me again.
Okay. Thank you. Padraig Tobin, you've supported the idea that deportations, people shouldn't be relied upon to self-deport. But, I mean, signing a tender for deportations and the price tag there, as you've seen, is €5 million. I mean, you majored on the issue of making decisions, responsible financial decisions during the election. What cost-benefit analysis did you do before you advocated the position of deportations?
Okay, so I think everybody around this table wants a situation where those fleeing war and violence are protected, okay? And those who are not fleeing war and violence, who are using the system, the system has determined that they should not be in the country, and that is the law. And I think everybody respects that. So there is an expectation amongst the vast majority of the general public that if you fail the asylum system, that you are removed from the country. Now, when I asked the minister what checks are there at the airports that person has left voluntarily, the minister said there are no checks. We have no facility to check if anybody has left the country. Right. When I've asked the minister where are these individuals, she has said, the previous minister said, she doesn't know where those individuals are.
Okay.
So
you support the principle of you support the principle of deportation. There's a price tag of about €350,000 put on a charter flight. I mean, seeing as somebody who measures on the spending of government money in your party's policies, what cost-benefit analysis have you done, even a back-of-an-envelope one, to say this is good value for money for the taxpayer for this to be done?
So if you have the vast majority of people who fail the system not leave the country, well, then obviously there's a cost within the state in terms of accommodation of those individuals. There's a cost of the state in a number of different factors as well. Also, if you look at other countries such as Denmark, who have implemented stricter processes in terms of their asylum processes, they have seen a significant fall in the number of people who actually apply for asylum in those countries as well,
They've talked before about deporting people back to Syria.
Yeah,
the Assad regime had fallen.
I'm not talking about that, but what I'm saying to you is this is a circuit. If it doesn't have integrity, well, then we know that it's going to have a difficulty in people actually adhering to the process. And the idea that a person who is not an asylum seeker, remember, if they have a deportation order, they are not an asylum seeker. They are using a system for asylum for another reason, maybe an economic reason, etc. If they want to get into the country for economic reasons, for sure, they should apply in terms of economic visas. But it's really important that we have a system with integrity.
Okay, Claire Curran, on the issue of deportations, I'd say there's a price tag has been put on what this tender is going to cost. Would you have any questions about that, or were there any sums done by your own party on whether or not this represented good value for money?
Yeah, so clearly, not least based on the response to the FOI that you've just read out, there is a lack of clarity and a lack of transparency in this whole area. But I suppose up to now, there has been that notion of, well, we've issued X number of deportation orders and there's no real follow through. So clearly there is a job of work to be done in terms of that. I mean, if the charter flight is costing €350,000, how many people are on that flight? I mean, the minister told us this week about 80% is the figure in terms of those that go through the process and aren't found to be able to remain here. So, I mean, what is that cost costing? Are they all going on a plane? How many countries are we talking? We need a lot more transparency in terms of what the figures and what the costs are. And then I suppose the other question is, what's the alternative if you don't spend that money and you don't charge the flight? And then the other side of that then is, as the Minister just said, if the vast majority are leaving of their own will, are they leaving themselves or do they require the flights to be chartered? Okay. I think that's an area where there probably hasn't been enough transparency or discussion.
All right, we need to take a break. After this, we're going to have a look at the issue of accommodation and some of the issues that have been raised by at least one traveller family we've been speaking to in Mayo, and we'll look at the broader issue with our panel as well. Take a break, back in a minute.
Saturday with Colm O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.